You are listening to WPR Wrestling Public Radio, Episode 4. Hello, and welcome to Wrestling Public Radio, the podcast for wrestling fans who don't like loud noises. I'm your host, Crystal Schmidt, and I want to thank you all for your continued listenership and support. I would like to also take a quick moment to plug the most recent episode of the Collect and Destroy podcast on YouTube and all audio streaming platforms. Baxter and I sat down to chat about all things Beetlejuice, from the movie to the animated series and toy lines. It was a really fun conversation and also quite exciting to do a live video broadcast. As some of you may have noticed, I took a week off from recording this podcast to mentally recharge, which I believe is so important for all of us this year, and I really encourage everyone to make things that re-energize you a priority as we head into the cold months of the year across much of the United States. I'm excited to bring you more stories about wrestlers you may or may not know much about. I'm also sincerely grateful for everyone joining us on this installment, so let's get started. Today we're going to approach arguably the most powerful professional wrestler of all time, but not for the reasons you might think. Not known for being the biggest or the most brutal of all wrestlers, Ted DiBiase is known for being the most powerful due to his endless source of cash. Settle in as we learn what happens when your life revolves around the idea that money isn't everything, it's the only thing. And everybody's got a price for the million-dollar man. Theodore Marvin DiBiase Sr. was born January 18, 1954, in Miami, Florida. His mother, Helen Wild, was a professional wrestler, as was his adopted father, Iron Mike DiBiase, who came into Ted's life when he was just 5 years old. Iron Mike DiBiase was famous for the sleeper hold. He would use the hold on audience members at events and actually put them to sleep in order to prove the authenticity of professional wrestling. In a tragic turn of events, Iron Mike died from a heart attack during a match in the summer of 1969, when Ted was only 15 years old. After his father's sudden death, Ted's mother, Helen, fell into a deep depression and alcoholism in all of her grief. As a result, Ted was sent to live with his grandparents in Willcox, Arizona. While living in Arizona, Ted began playing football and earned an athletic scholarship from West Texas State University. Other notable wrestling alumni of this college football organization include basically all of the Funks, Tully Blanchard, and Tito Santana. Upon suffering an injury during his senior year, however, Ted dropped out of college to begin his professional wrestling career, desperate to follow in his father's footsteps. Ted DiBiase was trained by Dory Funk Jr. and Terry Funk. He began his career in professional wrestling in 1974 at the age of 20 years old. His first match, he was actually a referee in the Amarillo Territory, which was owned by the Funks. The next summer, in 1975, Ted would move on to the Mid-South Territory, run by Bill Watts, where he was promoted as the son of Iron Mike DiBiase. He wrestled for Mid-South for 4 years. Around the start of his professional wrestling career, Ted got married, and in 1977, they had a son, named Mike, after Ted's father. Ted's first marriage dissolved, and he was divorced by the age of 26, around the year 1980. He would go on to meet his second wife, Melanie, in April of 1981, and they were married on New Year's Eve that same year. Their two sons, Ted Jr. and Brett, were born in 1982 and 1988, respectively. Ted DiBiase would enter a short run with WWE in 1979. He would become the first wrestler to hold the short-lived North American Championship title with the company. WWE had recently held a fictional tournament in Rio de Janeiro for the also-fictional South American Championship title, and the winner of that tournament, which never actually happened, was Pat Patterson. However, DiBiase would ultimately lose the North American title to Pat Patterson, who then merged the title with the fictional South American title to become the first ever Intercontinental Champion. The reason for this was that Vince McMahon Sr. didn't like the North American Championship and wanted something bigger, but not as big as the World Championship. DiBiase would return to Mid-South Wrestling after his stint with WWE, and it was during this run with Mid-South that he began a feud with Hacksaw Jim Duggan, in which the two began to define their characters as wrestlers. DiBiase focused on becoming a heel, or bad guy, while Hacksaw Jim Duggan stood out as a babyface, or good guy. As a heel, DiBiase would use the gimmick known as a loaded black glove, where he would place something rigid into the palm area of the glove he was wearing while the referee was distracted. He would then knock out his opponent with a punch from the loaded black glove. DiBiase would remain with Mid-South, which by then had been renamed UWF, Universal Wrestling Federation, for 7 years until it was bought in 1987 by Jim Crockett, who had taken over the TBS contract and was trying to go national. Bruce Pritchard had also been in Mid-South and was close friends with DiBiase. Bruce had been in talks with Vince McMahon over at WWE to negotiate his own contract with them, but he also felt compelled to ask Vince if Ted DiBiase might be someone WWE would be interested in signing. Vince immediately said yes to extending DiBiase a contract. Vince McMahon flew DiBiase out to discuss signing him with WWE, and that he had an idea for a gimmick specifically for him. However, before he would fully disclose the Million Dollar Man character to him, Vince wanted to make sure he had DiBiase's full commitment to WWE, so that he wouldn't have knowledge of the gimmick, opt out of the WWE contract, and take the idea along with him to a competitor. DiBiase called his good friend and trainer, Terry Funk, for advice on the matter, who told him that if Vince had a gimmick for him, he would be a fool not to take it. And as it turns out, this particular character was exactly the character Vince himself would play if he were wrestling, essentially because this was how Vince acted in real life. On Bruce Pritchard's podcast, he recalls a story of a time long before smoking bans ever became a thing, when he was flying first class with Vince McMahon and someone in the row behind them lit up a cigarette, and Vince offered the smoker $100 to put it out. The man declined, so Vince offered another $100. The man declined again. Vince then offered $500, and the guy declined one more time, stating that he had paid for the seat, so he would smoke if it suited him. So Vince finally says, "I will pay for your seat. I will give you $500 just to put out the cigarette." To which the man replied, "If it means that much to you, it's fine. I'll just go to sleep." And he rejects Vince's money. Bruce says that this was the moment when he was like, "Wow, Vince is actually the real-life Million Dollar Man." And DiBiase was able to take Vince McMahon's idea for the Million Dollar Man and bring it to life with his deep voice and condescending laughter that could cut to your core. It definitely feels like peering into how Vince thought he came across to people, except turned up one extra notch so the setting is at 11 instead of the normal 10 that Vince hovers around at all times. In order to keep kayfabe or authenticity of the gimmick intact, the Million Dollar Man would always carry money on him, in case he needed to shell out cash to display his wealth and power. Vince would provide DiBiase with a stipend of petty cash so that he could be more deliberately frivolous with spending by picking up tabs or buying drinks for the entire bar. Million Dollar Man would also fly first class and dine in the best restaurants, whereas most wrestlers were driving in groups in four-door sedans to get to the next city for matches. Million Dollar Man's wealth offered him other comforts as well, including the companionship of his bodyguard, Virgil. Some people connect the fact that Million Dollar Man's bodyguard was named Virgil as some kind of a diss to Jim Crockett's promotion, as the booker at the time was Dusty Rhodes, whose birth name is Virgil. Former writer and producer Bruce Prichard denies that this was a dig on the competitor and purely coincidental. It should also be noted, however, that Virgil was often tasked with humiliating things, like rubbing Million Dollar Man's feet, which may have been a further dig on the competition. The Million Dollar Man character actually debuted via a series of vignettes before making a live appearance. These beautifully curated short clips would not only put the character over with WWE fans, but it would also inspire a particular live sketch comedy show that we'll talk about later in this episode. Joel Watts and Bruce Prichard spent a week in Dallas, Texas with Ted to record the first set of these vignettes. I'll give you a brief description of a few of these, but highly recommend checking them out for yourself, and I'll make sure to put them on social media for you all. In one, Million Dollar Man is sitting in the back seat as Virgil is driving him around, and he's counting a stack of $100 bills as he lists all the things that he can buy with them, when he gets a paper cut and demands that he be taken to see a doctor. When they arrive, Million Dollar Man wants to be seen immediately, but the receptionist is not fazed. He has Virgil keep putting $100 bill after $100 bill on the receptionist's desk until she agrees to prioritize the Million Dollar Man's very urgent paper cut. He continues this trend, paying people off to meet his wants and desires. He bribes the manager of a public swimming pool to clear the pool so he can have private use of it. He also bribes a hotel manager to kick a newlywed couple out of the honeymoon suite so that he could have use of it instead. This is when the tagline, "Everybody's got a price for the Million Dollar Man," was created. He also displayed his wealth by riding around in limousines, giving $100 tips to servers, and using $100 bills in convenience stores for small purchases like a pack of chewing gum. To reference back to when I mentioned that the Million Dollar Man character ran parallel to Vince McMahon, the Million Dollar Man even went so far as to shoot some of the vignettes using Vince's house or cars or wearing his fur coat. The Million Dollar Man connected with the audience at live events as well, offering them money to perform tasks in front of a crowd. In fact, he invited a young man from Michigan into the ring on August 8, 1987, to kiss his stinky foot. That kid grew up to be none other than Rob Van Dam, who would have his own successful professional wrestling career. Despite trying to get the crowd to turn against him, the Million Dollar Man just wasn't getting the heel heat he desired, because people would instead get excited to get paid to do something quite menial. So then, the Million Dollar Man got wise and began purposely sabotaging the challenges presented to audience members. He once offered a child $300 if he could do 10 push-ups, and the kid fell at 9 push-ups. When the kid said, "I did my best," the Million Dollar Man quickly retorted, "Doing your best just ain't good enough for the Million Dollar Man. You don't get the money." And this is just one of several instances of the sort, where he would set kids up to intentionally fail at the tasks that he had asked of them. The Million Dollar Man also told a kid to bounce a basketball 15 times for $500. And when the kid got to the 14th dribble, Million Dollar Man kicked the ball out from under him so he couldn't finish the last one. The kid walked back to his mom so devastated. Million Dollar Man also had a woman get on all fours at a live event and told her to act like a dog. And when she barked, he said she hadn't done well enough to earn the money that he had offered. I don't know who this guy thought he was, making these innocent folks do all of this stuff and breaking kids' hearts on live television, but it really does make me feel a particular way about the wealthy elite. And if you all want to eat the rich after this episode, I don't blame you. A disclaimer I feel is important before any of you actually do eat the rich. All of the audience members who were denied payments were confirmed to have been paid behind the scenes when all was said and done. Come on, wrestling has some standards. The Million Dollar Man liked to use a sleeper hold on his opponents, which was also one of his dad's signature moves, as was mentioned earlier in the episode. He called his the Million Dollar Dream, however, and when his opponent would pass out, he would stuff a $100 bill in their mouth as a display of his power over them. However, it must be noted that more often than not, Virgil would retrieve the money from the opponent's mouth before they would leave the ring. Very rich guy vibes. In 1987, the Million Dollar Man announced his intent to buy the WWE World Championship title from Hulk Hogan, and Hogan would always tease it, but ultimately refuse. On February 5th, 1988, the main event aired live on NBC. Unbeknownst to Hogan, Andre the Giant had previously made a deal with the Million Dollar Man that once he became the world champion, he would agree to sell him the title. This was one of the most watched matches in pro wrestling history. The match was infamous for the "Who is the real Dave Hebner?" twin referee spot. Dave Hebner was scheduled to be the referee for that match, but his real-life twin brother, Earl Hebner, impersonated him and called the match instead. When Earl counted the finishing pin for Andre, despite Hogan's shoulder being up at the count of one, the real Dave Hebner came running into the ring to dispute the ruling, saying that his evil twin was at work here. Andre was still awarded the world championship and immediately surrendered the title belt to the Million Dollar Man right in front of Hulk Hogan, who watched in disbelief. WWE President Jack Tunney declared that Million Dollar Man was in fact not the champion and would be stripped of the title as he had not won by pin or submission. He also stated that because Andre had surrendered the title, it was therefore vacant. Andre the Giant's world title win was still recognized, though it is to this day considered the shortest world title reign in WWE history. This storyline would lead up to Million Dollar Man's first WrestleMania, WrestleMania 4, in 1988. At this WrestleMania, Million Dollar Man defeated an old foe from his Mid-South territory days, Hacksaw Jim Duggan, in the first round of the tournament. He defeated Don Morocco in the quarterfinals before receiving a bye round in the semifinals, which automatically advanced him to the finals of the tournament. The reason he was awarded a bye was a double elimination of Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant when they were both disqualified in their match, with Million Dollar Man meant to face the winner. In a backstage interview afterwards, Andre reveals that the Million Dollar Man had paid him to make sure that Hogan didn't advance in the tournament. In the finals, however, Million Dollar Man was defeated by Macho Man Randy Savage. The feud between Million Dollar Man and Macho Man would last throughout the summer of 1988, coming to a head in a tag team match pitting Million Dollar Man and Andre the Giant versus Hulk Hogan and Macho Man Randy Savage at the inaugural SummerSlam. The match was billed as "Where the Mega Powers Meet the Mega Bucks." Hogan ended up pinning Million Dollar Man to win that match. It wouldn't be until October 16th, 1988, that the Million Dollar Man would see his first somewhat properly earned success in WWE when he won the fourth annual King of the Ring tournament at the Dunkin' Donuts Center, which was then known as the Providence Civic Center in Providence, Rhode Island, which is where I currently reside. Million Dollar Man defeated Brutus Beefcake, Ken Patera and finally Randy Savage to take the title of King of the Ring that year. Also in October of 1988, the Million Dollar Man was involved in a storyline with fellow wrestler Hercules, whose contract he had recently purchased from Bobby Heenan, stating that he was going to make Hercules a slave. If you recall, the Million Dollar Man also had a black man for a bodyguard who acted as more of a servant. This gives off bad vibes by today's standards, and honestly should have given off bad vibes back then, too, but everyone always says, times were different back then, and that's really just not a good excuse if you ask me, Bruce. In November of 1988, Hercules fought in a match against Virgil in a Battle for Freedom match. Bruce Pritchard, in his podcast, attempts to dismiss the fact that they blatantly put what amounted to two enslaved people in a ring to fight one another in an effort to gain their own freedom by saying, they were pieces of property in the Million Dollar Man's mind, as if that's not the entire point. The two are not mutually exclusive, and that's entirely the reason why we must not glorify human chattel slavery in popular culture. So, in February of 1989, the Million Dollar Man went to a jewelry store with the rationale that if he could not win the world championship, he would create his own title and call it the Million Dollar Belt. When he and Bruce Pritchard initially went to film some vignettes at the jewelry store as the belt was being made, they got to see the jewelers working on it, and they were fashioning quite a small belt, more like something for everyday wear to hold up one's pants. Bruce estimates that Vince McMahon probably spent about $25,000 to $30,000 for the belt once finalized. To buy some time as the belt was being redone, and to provide some content for viewers, the Million Dollar Man filmed some vignettes in the jewelry store, overlooking the progress of the belt and saying, I need more gold. I need more diamonds. On the day he arrived to pick up the finished Million Dollar Belt, he burst into Betteridge Jewelers wearing a black cape with red lining, much like a Dracula cape, raised his arms in the air, and exclaimed, I'm here, I'm here, the Million Dollar Man is here, and I want my belt. He beckons the owner of the store, who arrives carrying the belt to the counter. As the protective cloth is removed, we don't get to see the belt as viewers. We only see Million Dollar Man's reaction, which involves him carrying on about how powerful he will be with this belt, and the vignette wraps with him throwing his head back and laughing maniacally. The Million Dollar Belt is revealed on the Brother Love show. It's quite impressive, with massive gold dollar signs and encrusted with diamonds. It's also revealed on this segment that Brother Love's benefactor is actually the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, and that's how he has progressively been afforded finer things throughout his storyline. Brother Love, as some may know, is Bruce Pritchard, who has been at the side of Ted DiBiase since before his career with WWE began. In February of 1990, the Million Dollar Man beat Jake the Snake Roberts on Main Event. Jake the Snake then stole the Million Dollar Belt in retaliation, and this ignited a feud leading up to WrestleMania VI. In a skit for the Brother Love show, Jake the Snake had put the Million Dollar Belt inside the bag he always carried his Burmese python, Damien, in. He explained to the Million Dollar Man that he could have his belt back if only he reached into the bag to grab it. But instead of Million Dollar Man carrying out the task himself, he of course offered to pay someone else to do it. The Million Dollar Belt was a precious commodity that was to be protected at all costs. But it was once feared that it had been lost for good. Bruce Pritchard tells a story of a time when he and DiBiase had been traveling together and stopped at a restaurant in Boston for a bite to eat. When they returned to their car after their meal, a man in the parking lot was approaching them, saying, "Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, let's make a deal." And that's when the pair noticed that the back window of their car had been smashed in. So they were assuming that this guy had just stolen their belongings, and now he was going to offer to sell their stuff back to them for the right price. As it turns out, that man only wanted an autograph and hadn't busted out the window at all. But he was so flustered by the implication that he ran off yelling that he hadn't done that. DiBiase and Bruce started going through the car to see what had all been stolen, and DiBiase realized that the $1 million belt wasn't in the vehicle. They argued a moment over who was going to call Mr. McMahon to explain the situation, and finally, Bruce got on a payphone to take the heat. It was the middle of the night, and Vince yelled at Bruce to raise hell with the press about it to get someone to take action. After thinking about it while Bruce was getting chewed out by Vince, DiBiase wondered if perhaps his bodyguard Virgil had taken the belt back to the hotel with him earlier that evening. They called Virgil, and he frankly replied that the belt had been with him all along. After buying the services of Sapphire, who was managing Dusty Rhodes at the time, the $1 million man set off a feud with Dusty. In October 1990, DiBiase attacked Dusty's son, Dustin Rhodes, in the front row during Dusty's match against Randy Savage. DiBiase and Dusty would end up captaining rival teams at Survivor Series in November of that year, where DiBiase would announce a mystery partner for his $1 million team, which turned out to be the WWE debut of The Undertaker. Million Dollar Man, attacking a young Dustin Rhodes a few months prior, set up a tag team match between Million Dollar Man and Virgil versus Dusty and Dustin Rhodes at Royal Rumble in January 1991. After Million Dollar Man and Virgil secured the win, DiBiase ordered Virgil to take the $1 million championship belt and put it on him. But instead, Virgil turned on him and hit DiBiase with the belt. At WrestleMania 7 that year, Virgil defeated Million Dollar Man in a match via countout thanks to some help he received from Rowdy Roddy Piper. During the match, Sensational Sherry Martel came out to try to provide support for Million Dollar Man as she had turned on Randy Savage that same night. Sherry would become Million Dollar Man's full-time valet because of her portrayal of Randy Savage. However, the truth behind the move was that Randy was leaving the company, and this would provide an appropriate opportunity to begin a new storyline for both Sherry and DiBiase. Shortly after the Royal Rumble in 1992, Million Dollar Man quietly dropped Sherry Martel as his valet so that she could manage Shawn Michaels. He then formed the tag team known as Money Incorporated with Irwin R. Scheister, aka IRS. The duo, managed primarily by Jimmy Hart, won the tag team championship several times during their run in the tag team division of WWE. In 1993, the Million Dollar Man clashed with Razor Ramon, who some may know as Scott Hall. Razor had just lost a match to newcomer 123 Kid, somewhat better known as X-Pac, and DiBiase just would not cease with giving Razor a hard time about that loss. This brings us to a match between Million Dollar Man and Razor Ramon at SummerSlam 1993, which is the last match for DiBiase for a long time. The kayfabe of the Million Dollar Man had meticulously interwoven itself into Ted DiBiase's everyday life, as kayfabe was wont to do in the 80s because professional wrestling was still very much projected as entirely unscripted and not at all predetermined. Ted DiBiase took this persona so seriously that it sort of turned him into a narcissist, or perhaps encouraged and brought to the forefront a narcissism that had already existed within. DiBiase doesn't use this as an excuse, but rather a contributing factor to his excessive drinking, drug use, and sex outside of his monogamous marriage to Melanie. On a phone call with his wife, DiBiase was outed for his infidelity, and Melanie told him he no longer could come back home because he didn't live there anymore. He would ultimately take a leave from WWE to use the time to begin to repair his marriage, and despite Melanie's initial reaction to the knowledge of Ted cheating on her, she insisted that it be kept a secret from their sons so as not to disrupt their normalcy or give them a poor impression of their father. It was decided that the couple would work with a counselor to help mend the broken marriage and get Ted back on the right track. Ted DiBiase has a documentary from 2017 titled The Price of Fame, which is available right now for streaming on Amazon Prime. It covers much of the grief Ted experienced from losing his father at a young age and under such tragic circumstances. But even more so, the documentary focuses on what the million-dollar man gimmick did to Ted and in turn his marriage with Melanie. During his time away from WWE, DiBiase did do a couple tours with All Japan Pro Wrestling. However, he re-aggravated an old spine injury during these tours. He was examined by medical professionals and told that he could no longer wrestle due to the progression of the injury. When he returned to the States a few months after leaving for Japan, he retired from the ring in 1993. At the Royal Rumble in January of 1994, DiBiase returned to WWE as a guest commentator, but his persona and skill set didn't end up translating very well for that role. So he ended up moving on to form the Million Dollar Corporation within the company, which lasted for about a year. He acted as manager over quite a handful of WWE wrestlers at that time, including his former tag team partner IRS, Bam Bam Bigelow, Nikolai Volkoff, Kama, King Kong Bundy, Psycho Sid, 123 Kid, and Tatanka. To close out the summer of 1994, the Million Dollar Man had announced that Million Dollar Corporation was going to reintroduce The Undertaker at SummerSlam after he had been on a 6-month hiatus. DiBiase debuted a brand new Undertaker under his full control. However, we learn that this Undertaker ends up being an imposter played by Brian Lee, and he was subsequently defeated by the real Undertaker at SummerSlam. This storyline is commonly referred to as the Underfaker versus the Undertaker. Near the end of 1995, the Million Dollar Man began searching for a new Million Dollar Champion with whom to bestow the legendary title belt he had made. During an episode of The Brother Love Show in January 1996, they debuted a new Million Dollar Champion called the Ringmaster Steve Austin, before he became our beloved Stone Cold. Vince McMahon didn't like Steve Austin's Texas accent, so he wanted to use Ted DiBiase as a mouthpiece for the wrestler. Paul Heyman, however, told Bruce Pritchard that if they were debuting Steve Austin, they needed to give Steve the mic. So when it came time on the Brother Love Show, Bruce opted to give Steve the mic, and he did so well that Vince agreed he didn't need DiBiase to speak on his behalf. Towards the end of Ted's contract with WWE, in May of 1996, there was a stipulation match where, if the ringmaster Steve Austin lost, Ted would have to leave the company. Steve lost to Savio Vega, and DiBiase did indeed leave WWE. However, in reality, he was moving to WCW World Championship Wrestling. DiBiase debuted in WCW on August 26, 1996, revealing himself as the fourth member of the NWO New World Order, alongside Scott Hall, Kevin Nash, and Hollywood Hogan. He claimed to be financing the group, seemingly playing off of his Million Dollar Man persona without being referred to as such. He was jokingly referred to by the members of NWO as Trillionaire Ted, which was a reference to Billionaire Ted, the disparaging nickname that WWE staff had given to WCW owner Ted Turner. DiBiase was the spokesperson for NWO for 3 months until Eric Bischoff aligned with NWO and replaced him. As a result of this move, Ted would make a face turn and manage the Steiner brothers, leading them to 2 World Tag Team Championships. After the Steiner brothers split as a result of Scott betraying Rick, DiBiase managed Ray Traylor for a while until he quit managing altogether. He became a road agent for the company and left entirely when his contract expired in late 1999. Some years later, in late 2004, WWE offered DiBiase a role on the creative team that he accepted and worked in for about a year and a half. In April of 2005, he was hired as a creative consultant and road agent for the SmackDown brand of WWE. In 2006, the Million Dollar Man inducted his former valet, Sensational Sherry Martel, into the WWE Hall of Fame. He also made an appearance at WrestleMania 22 that same weekend, where he offered professional wrestler Eugene $1,000 to dribble a basketball 100 times backstage, and then kicked the ball away from him at the last second. On October 26, 2006, DiBiase was released from his WWE contract. Ted DiBiase made his first in-ring appearance in over 5 years at Raw's 15th anniversary special on December 10, 2007, by winning a 15-man battle royal in which he wasn't even an active participant. IRS, DiBiase's former tag team partner of Money Incorporated, had won the battle royal. The Million Dollar Man came down ringside and offered IRS a bribe to eliminate himself. IRS accepted and hopped over the top rope, leaving DiBiase the victor. He pompously declared that, even after 15 years, everyone still had a price for the Million Dollar Man. The Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, was inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame in 2010 by his sons Ted Jr. and Bret DiBiase. It's worth noting the impact that Ted had on his sons, all three of whom became professional wrestlers and had careers in WWE and NWA. During his acceptance speech, Ted thanked his wife Melanie for giving him a second chance, and also thanked his God. Both Ted and Melanie give a lot of credit to their God in the Price of Fame documentary, for the reason that their marriage is still intact nearly 40 years later. In fact, Ted is now an ordained minister who does a lot of outreach to struggling professional wrestlers. In 2011, DiBiase also inducted one of his oldest friends and opponents in the ring, Hacksaw Jim Duggan, into the WWE Hall of Fame. On July 22, 2019, he was welcomed back to WWE after they had created the 24/7 championship title, which I've previously mentioned is a belt that can be won via pin or submission anywhere and any place so long as a referee is present to officiate it. You might recall from the last episode of Wrestling Public Radio that Alundra Blaze was also present that night, and was the first person to win the 24/7 championship via submission. Well, Million Dollar Man showed up and conveniently offered Alundra the right price, and she sold the title to him. The 26-year span of this time between his last victory in 1993 and him holding the 24/7 title is reportedly the longest in WWE history. He later lost the title to Drake Maverick in a limousine on the same night. To round things out, after a very detailed account on just how influential the Million Dollar Man was within wrestling and Ted DiBiase's personal life, I feel it's imperative to share how he inspired pop culture as well, even if unintentionally. He had a quote that went, "I like money, of course, but what I really like is what the money can make people do for me. Now, I'm a generous man, and I've given many people many an opportunity to make some of my money for doing the most ordinary things to my satisfaction." End quote. Leading up to the 1992 presidential election, the candidates of the two primary U.S. political parties were Democratic Governor Bill Clinton and incumbent Republican President George H.W. Bush. That's George W. Bush's dad, for everyone not familiar with anything pre-2000 politically. However, from apparently nowhere came an independent candidate named Ross Perot, who was a self-made millionaire at the time. Sounds familiar, right? Now, stay with me here while we make this leap. As is customary during any presidential election year, live sketch comedy show Saturday Night Live began running skits parodying the presidential candidates. Dana Carvey actually worked double duty somehow, filling the shoes of both George H.W. Bush and Ross Perot during this time, and did brilliant work. It was his portrayal of rich guy Ross Perot that resonates deeply with the Million Dollar Man, however, that leads one to believe some of the writers for SNL may have been inspired by Ted DiBiase's performance on screen. Specifically, when I informed consultant and friend of the podcast, Jason Garcia, of the subject of this week's episode, I was urged by them to check out the SNL skit referred to as Powerful Ross Perot. And when I did so, it felt like I was watching some extended footage of the vignettes of the Million Dollar Man. I will do my best to describe it in detail, but it is hysterical to witness for oneself, and I'll be sure to get it up on all social media to use as a reference. In this particular scene, we see Dana Carvey as Ross Perot. He is small in stature compared to what is presumed to be his bodyguard, Roy, played by Kevin Nealon. Ross Perot accosts a bystander, played by Phil Hartman, and begins talking to him about the president being a very powerful man, but that there are other kinds of power, like his, for example. He says, "I got $3.3 million. That kind of financial power, I can make people do things they maybe don't want to do, or ever thought of doing." And he offers Phil Hartman $20 to take off his glasses, then $35 just to pull up his socks. This was all in an effort for Ross Perot to display that he has power over someone simply because he has money. Then, Julia Sweeney gets off the elevator and Ross Perot says, "She will be ours, Roy," to Kevin Nealon, who's in charge of handing out the money similar to the way Virgil would pay people off for the Million Dollar Man at his every command. Ross Perot offers Julia $100 to read his watch and tell him the time. Roy pays her, and Ross goes, "If you have a number 2 pencil in your purse, I'll give you $500. You got 10 seconds. And when she only has a pen, he responds, "Well, a billy goat's not a coyote, and a pen is not a number 2 pencil," withholding the money from her. He then offers the same woman $350 to say the word suppository, above a whisper, but softer than your average conversational speaking voice. And she does. He sends her off, saying, "Here's $50 that says you're gonna hop on out of here." And she happily does a bunny hop out of the lobby. Ross Perot finally accosts a third bystander, played by comedy legend Chris Farley, in the same lobby, and offers him $100 just to change the part in his hair. When he does this, Ross quickly says, "Change it back again." And when Farley moves his hair back to its original part, Ross says, "I didn't say I'd give you anything, did I? Now, you're not listening, and that's just sad." and then offers Farley $200 to get down on all fours, and progressively gets more vulgar with his requests. $250 to act like a pig, $500 more to be an angry pig, another $2,000 to be a vicious, spitting hog. Ross yelled, $5,000 says, I'm going to ride my piggy man. And he mounts Chris Farley's back, and they ride toward the camera and off screen. Roy just nods and says, now that is one powerful man. The striking resemblance of these monetary offers for trivial tasks, the embarrassing nature of some of the tasks, and the enjoyment that the wealthy person got from exploiting the economic disparity between himself and those around him cannot be purely coincidental. These fictional skits and vignettes, even if a bit exaggerated, offer a very real glimpse at how money creates power and how those in power often exert it in a way that continues to systemically oppress those who are from a lower economic status. What the true story of Ted DiBiase shows is that adopting a specific fictional persona can take a toll on the person that you are and aim to be. It serves as a reminder for me personally to be honest with myself and with those around me, that honesty will build better foundations for my mental health as well as my relationships with others. In closing, I want to thank you all again for joining me today as we ventured through the development of the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, from a small town in Arizona to the WWE Hall of Fame. Join us next time for more tales of the wrestling world and how pop culture and the world around us shape storylines. In the meantime, you can access updates and additional content about all episodes on Twitter at WPR Media, as well as Facebook and Instagram at Wrestling Public Radio. This is Crystal Schmidt signing off for Wrestling Public Radio.